And I would recommend it. Again, Innes will be doing a review of cases in the last year, and there have been some cases that would make it worth turning out just for that bit. Of course, if you're not a member, then you can't vote, but then if you want to join, then not only will you get a compliment, but a vote to go with it. In addition to that, we have a close working association with the West of Scotland Dowsers. And they've got a couple of events quite soon, from 1:30 to 4 on Sunday the 4th of December, in the usual location, the Theosophical Lodge, 17 Queen's Crescent. They've got a social afternoon. But the focus, the theme for the afternoon, is a slideshow revisiting a field trip to Aberdeen that was done in May of this year. And that was an interesting field trip, which is why they want to introduce some points from it to a wider audience. If you have an interest in dowsing, I would recommend that you go on a field trip. But if for some reason you can't, and it is quite an investment of time, then this would be an excellent way to get the learning outcomes from field trip and at minimum cost in a very convenient location. I was also asked by Mishka to say to people that you're expected to bring something to share, and it's not an observation in dowsing. It would be something to make it a more convivial and hospitable evening, something non-alcoholic to drink perhaps, something to eat, but something that if everybody brings it, there'll be a real convivial atmosphere. They also have another event, 7:30 on Wednesday the 18th of January, our very own Innes Smith. This is getting to be a habit. Innes Smith, and where are we now? His own review of all things spooky, paranormal, and so on. And Innes is well-read and very creative in his approach to things. So even if you've done your own review and you think you've got it tickety-boo, if you listen to him, he'll confuse you. And he'll get you to think about something you think you know about a little differently. A good evening, then, in the Theosophical Lodge, same location. Looking ahead to our own lectures, after the AGM in January, there's Dr. Jude Curwen, always a popular choice, and Thursday the 2nd of February, she'll be speaking about healing, but healing on a planetary scale, healing on a massive scale, and the reasons why she has hope for next year, and not everybody does, of course, but in 2012, but the reason why she does have hope, and for the years beyond. She's producing a new book, and hopefully that'll be available, but a very popular choice for those of you who don't know her. And just to flag up early on, we have a demonstration of mediumship. It's a fundraising event in addition to a normal programme, and you'll be reminded about that, of course, in January and February. But for those of you who wish to even order tickets this evening, the council members at the front, particularly Carolyn, the treasurer, will be happy to take your money and note your name and get the tickets to you in due course. The demand for tickets for these particular evenings can get quite intense nearer the time. Don't leave it too late. And before I introduce our speaker tonight, I've been handed by one of our members something that should be of interest. It's Sense Scotland, a well-known charity, one that I support, has a Christmas charity ghost hunt. It's on Saturday the 3rd of December from 9 p.m. to 3 a.m, so it's for night owls only. It's in Renfrew Victory Bars. Now, that's a location that was flagged up to our society a few years ago. and it was suggested that we go in for an overnight vigil. We didn't, for various reasons, but another group did, and they claimed to have some spooky experiences. And it's attracted some interest since. So for those of you who fancy doing something for charity, another have a bit of fun maybe, but maybe also have an experience that will leave you thinking, then here's an easy good cause to support. For tonight, we are recording the speaker because we have his permission to do so, but I would just ask that people don't make unapproved recordings. It caused a problem for us recently. And if you have mobile phones, as I do, then please switch it off. Yeah, you'll not catch me out now. Please switch them off. Otherwise, you'll be heckled. This magazine here is attracting considerable interest, even outside our society. Who knows where this publication will end up. But for tonight, Carolyn brought along just a few copies, and she thinks she only has five left. So if you want to buy one, it's £3. It's the Sci Review, and it's worth the money. And it's only going to get better, I think, as more and more members get on board with contributing to it. Members can contribute to it if you're a visitor. Apart from a compliment and a vote, you become a member and you get the chance to contribute to something like this too. Become a published writer and it's free of charge. I just want to point out, because it's in my mind, that a couple of our members got married recently. Magdalene, who I don't think is here tonight, married this handsome fellow up here who was dressed in Highland outfit, Mark Robertson. Give people a wee wave, Mark. Would it be true, Mark, to say that you met through this society? Yeah, so you see, if you're a member, normally after lectures we meet in Otto's Wine Bar, and for those of you who don't know where it is, you go out University Avenue, turn left, go down Byers Road, and it's the first pub in the corner, opposite the hospital. And in there, the chat is often with the lecturer. Unfortunately, David has to rush off for a train this evening. But there'll be other council members there and people who are into habit of following up the lecture with something that's a good deal more informal, and there's some good chats take place there. People say things that they wouldn't say in a larger forum. So I would recommend that. I think that's covered the announcements. It now is just for me to introduce our speaker. An acquaintance of mine, Emma Holman Tyre, a Native American Indian teacher. He has a particular ritual from his culture which he has called the fire dance. And earlier this year he was standing in front of 100 people in Glasgow. It was an amazing sight because it was a community hall in which there was a fire and an altar in the centre. And people were dancing around it, including the janitors. And that was the most impressive thing about it. If you can get a Janny enthused to come off his shift and join you, then you must have a good activity. And Emma stood up, having come all the way from New Mexico, and he said, and I can't imitate his accent, but he said, "The fire dance has come to you. The fire dance has come to you." What does that say about you? The idea is that he'd come all the way from Mexico to Glasgow because he recognised that there is something mystical, something special, something unique about the Glaswegian approach to esoteric and spiritual subjects. But he didn't go on to explain. He left everyone to think, what does it say about you. When a speaker comes all the way from Windsor, and not for the first time, for no other reason than to speak to you, what does that say about you? And we know what it says about him. We know what it says about him. But I think it says something about our society.
We're gorgeous.
That may be true for you, madam. But I'm looking at some guys behind you. And if it does say something, that we can ask speakers to come from various parts of the world, and from sunny England to rainy Scotland, that it says something about our members. Bear that in mind. David Hamilton has established an international reputation in recent years, for his unbridled enthusiasm for tackling subjects that we've taken for granted and applying a rigorous scientific scrutiny to it. I think he says in his website he likes to fuse subjects together. Having read some of his books, I think he's more likely to blow a fuse. Some of what he says will be inspirational. Some of it might be transformative. All of it will be scientific. And that's what appeals to this society. Let's give him a big Glasgow welcome.
Can you hear me okay? Is that mic working okay?
Yeah.
You can tell by the accent that I live in Windsor, eh? Now, we moved there about six years ago or something like that. Same town as the Queen. I live about 3/4 of a mile from the Queen. And she's never popped in for tea. I'm taking it personally.
I'm just kidding, yes.
What was I saying there? The subject I want to cover, for those of you who don't really know much about what I do, how I got into this, just a wee short recap. I used to work in a big pharmaceutical company called AstraZeneca, and I used to build cardiovascular and cancer drugs, which basically means really stick the atoms together and to make these big things. But I got more interested in the mind-consciousness aspect, because what really fascinated me was when loads of people get a drug and loads of people get better, then you've got to prove the drug works, you have to give loads of people a fake version of the drug, which is usually made of shock or sugar or something like that, called a placebo. But loads of people get better than that as well. And I was so interested in that, because my field was cardiovascular, mainly cardiovascular. My first drug was an antihypertensive, and placebo effects are not uncommon to be over 80%. Sometimes the placebo effect will account for 80 to 90% of the effect of the drug. And I thought that was just so amazing. So I resigned from the industry and started diving into the whole aspect of the mind, consciousness, and how does that interact with your life and with your experience of life, with even the health of your body. And tonight, the subject, I call it the contagious power of thinking. The book actually started out called The Contagious Power of Kindness, because what I was trying to do is I wanted to see if I could find enough really strong scientific evidence that would suggest that a small group of people with compassion and kindness in their hearts could change the world. And through that, what I was trying to do was see if the act of kindness itself could create a ripple effect. So I'll leave you to draw your own conclusions by the end of the talk and see if you think that there's evidence here that suggests that a small group of people with compassion and kindness in their hearts could change the world. But before I go into what I'm going to predominantly talk about is how emotions are contagious. In fact, you know, Harvard University, arguably the most famous university in the world, they did a study, a happiness study, and they looked at a social network of 12,000 people with approximately 250,000 social contacts. Right? Now what that means is, if there's like 100 people in the room here, that would be a social network of 100 people. But if you had to write down all the people that you're friendly with, then what you would find is you know some people in here, and these people up here know the same people. And then you know other people. What you would start to draw is wee lines to all of your connections. And what you'd end up with is 100 wee points, but hundreds, like a thousand or so many thousands of little connections. That's your social connections. And when Harvard created this social network, they followed it over a period of 4 years. They followed people's mental health over 4 years. And you know what they found? Is that approximately 25% of the average person's happiness level at any one time has nothing whatsoever to do with the circumstances of their life, nor any self-development work they're involved in, not even their genetic predisposition, but it's actually a consequence of the emotional state of your friends. Right? Isn't that extraordinary? We actually catch emotions from people. It's called emotional contagion. We project emotion, we infect other people, and we are the recipients of it all the time. Before I get into that, I want to tell you a wee quick something that popped into my mind just before I came and did the talk. Because I had to use the Dyson Airblade for something. Anyone who's used the toilets and tried to wash your hands, the water goes and dumps it all over your shirt. So you know what I was doing actually just before the talk? The first time I spoke on this subject, right, there's a point to the story, by the way. The first time I spoke on this subject was at the London Mind Body Spirit Festival back in May. And I'd arrived at the Royal Horticultural Halls to do my talk. And it was about half an hour before I was due to speak, and I thought, you know, I could go a wee cup of coffee. And I said to my publicist, I said, do you fancy a wee coffee? I'll nip down to the cafe downstairs. And she said, oh, that'd be really great, thanks. So I nipped down the cafe, and I ordered a couple of cups of coffee. And the manager or the server put the lids on, and the lids really didn't fit that well. And I was going, my God, it's going to fall off. And I came up and I handed one cup to Joe, my publicist, and I said, you better watch the lid here, it's a bit kind of shaky. She goes, oh, thanks very much. And then I completely forgot what I just told her. I was wearing this exact shirt, right? And as I tried to take a drink of it, I was now wearing the coffee. And I had this now we're talking 25 minutes before my talk, and I now had this massive coffee stain right down the right-hand side of this exact shirt. And I thought, what am I going to do? There's no time to nip out buying a new shirt. And you're thinking, this is a really big coffee stain. It's really dark, dark, dark brown. And I thought, the only thing I can do is nip down to the toilet and see if I can clear it. So I run down to the toilets and I'm pouring hot water. And I'm going, obviously it doesn't work. So I start putting the soap, the hand gel. And I'm now hot water hand gel. And I'm using my fingernails to scratch the coffee out there. But you know what? Testimony to the power of good hard work. I managed to get it pretty clean. I mean, really, really clean. I was really impressed, actually. But now, 15-20 minutes before my talk, I'm totally soaking wet on the right-hand side. And I thought, what can I do? I'll go under the hand dryer. But obviously, they didn't have a normal hand dryer. They've got these daft Dyson air blades. This wee wafer thing. And I thought, So I thought, I'll take my shirt off and put it inside the air blade. I'll tell you. It was like a flag drying in the wind. It was a... And just like it did 10 minutes ago, it dried my shirt in about 25 seconds. But get this, I ironed it as well. Because I put it back on. And the front of it on the left-hand side was the ironing job I did in the morning, which really wasn't that good. But this side was totally ironed. So I walked back up to my publisher's stand, and Jo's drinking a coffee, and she goes, And she couldn't work it out. How on earth? I could be totally clean. Not only clean, but dry and ironed. About the 5 minutes. So I explained the story. So although I'm going to talk about how emotions are contagious, I think good ideas are contagious. And we can do a wee scientific test. And the premise of the test is, in the next year or so, from time to time when you go to look at a Dyson Airblade, you'll work out if the idea of the drying shirts is contagious. If the next time you go to put your hand in and you see a wee thing with a wee pair of hands saying 10 seconds and beside it there's a wee shirt that says 25 seconds, you know you heard it here first. I invented that application of it. So anyway, I wasn't planning to tell you that. I just popped into my head when a similar kind of thing happened just through the door there about 10 minutes ago. So what I was actually going to talk about is we catch emotions from people all the time. Right? And the way it works is we have this little group of cells in the brain that it's a kind of interconnected network, and it's called the mirror neuron system. Right? The mirror neuron system. It's really like a high-definition camera. Imagine you've got a high-definition camera in your head, inside your head, and every time you look around at people, It's recording in really high definition everyone's movements. Right, where it gets interesting is it records your expression of emotion. And the name mirror neuron system comes from the fact that it mirrors what you see. So for example, if a person's happy, then they might be smiling a lot. So they'll be doing that and laughing and exercising this muscle, which is called your zygomaticus major muscle, pulls your lips out and smile. And that one there, when you really genuinely laugh, your orbicularis oculi. You can always tell if someone's, if you tell a joke and people laugh, you know if they're really laughing at the joke or if they're doing a pity laugh or a fake laugh. If you don't see any movement here, you know that they're not really laughing at your joke, they're just being polite. But if they're really laughing at you, you get movement of the orbicularis oculi. You don't need to know those names, I just think they sound pretty cool. So you've got that one there and that one there. So if you're smiling a lot, if you're happy, then the happiness will be written all over your face. Right? So the mirror neuron system will in other people, if you're with someone who's happy a lot, then your mirror neuron system will copy that movement and that movement. Now what it does then is it sends a feedback signal into the emotional circuitry of your brain and replicates in you the emotion that corresponds to the movement of that muscle and that muscle. See, this requires a new definition of what an emotion is. Most people would think an emotion is just your subjective experience, your feeling. Right? But that's only, if you really go think about it, that's only a one quarter of what emotion is. You cannot disentangle the subjective feeling of emotion from the chemistry in the brain that follows that or comes before it. Right? You also, when you feel an emotion, you also have an impact on your autonomic nervous system. Your vagus nerve, for example, stimulates the rhythms of your heart. You have an impact on all of your organ systems in the body, depending on what emotion you're feeling. You only have to think about something that stresses you and you immediately stimulate your adrenal glands. Starting point, a little area called the hypothalamus in the brain. And that stimulates the adrenal glands. And you start to flood the body with stress chemistry. So you get that. But the fourth part of emotion is the effect on your peripheral nervous system, which is your muscles, which is the facial muscles, these muscles. If you're feeling happy, you'll probably find your shoulders will be lowered and your chest will be open. If you're feeling sad, you'll probably find your shoulders will be up at your ears, your chest will fold, and then you will hardly be breathing, you'll be shallow breathing. So you have this outward expression of emotion. So you have the feeling, you have the chemistry in the brain, you have the impact on the autonomic nervous system, and you have the impact on your muscles. So emotion you can't disentangle from any one of these four things. What's interesting is if you change any one of these four things, it changes the list. Right? So if you change how you feel by thinking happy thoughts, then you change the chemistry of the brain, you change the impact on your organs, you change the muscles, the facial expressions, etc. If you change the muscles, then you also change the chemistry of the brain, but you also change the subjective feeling. So for example, if you want to feel really sad, then just try walking about like that for half an hour in shallow breathing, you'll probably feel terrible. But if you want to feel better, open your chest and breathe and actually pay attention to your breathing and try to smile. Regular intervals go like that. And laugh at yourself. Even better if you do it in front of the mirror. But all of these things are all part of the emotional circuitry of the entire body. Emotion is actually smeared throughout the entire organism. Right? So if you change, you intervene in any one part by changing the chemistry or the body language, then you get the emotional change as well. Now, the reason I'm telling you that is because this is how emotional contagion, the contagiousness of emotion actually gets transmitted. Because if a person's feeling happy, the happiness will be reflected throughout the organism. Physically, on the facial muscles, zygomaticus major, the orbicularis oculi, the muscles here, the breathing rate, pupil diameter, all that kind of stuff, even the vocal tone, all of that will be an outward expression of the emotion. Your mirror neuron system will copy that. Right? It's largely unconscious. I know people who do NLP, copy people, mirror people on purpose to build rapport. And that's, you do that on purpose. Now what I'm referring to is a largely unconscious process. It's called the chameleon effect. You know, a chameleon becomes like its environment, so we become like each other, emotionally first. And so this is a largely unconscious process. So if a person is feeling an emotion and wearing it all over their body, their shoulders, the way they're holding their body, their pupil diameter, vocal intonations, facial expressions, then your mirror neuron system will copy that. So the longer you're with that person, the more your facial muscles We'll start to do that. And if they're happy, the more activity you'll find in your zygomaticus major and your orbicularis oculi. And the more you'll find yourself breathing deeply. Now, contrast that with someone who's feeling angry. The longer you're with someone who's angry, you'll find the more your mirror neuron system will, instead of mirroring this muscle and that muscle, will actually mirror this one, which is called your corrugator supercilii. These all sound like science fiction names, eh? In fact, zygomaticus major actually sounds like the son of somebody that works at NASA. This is my son, zygomaticus major. anyway, what was I talking about then? The corrugator supercilii. Right. So, if someone's really angry, there'll be lots of activity there. They will probably also have their chest up, and there'll be facial muscles tense. So, 43 facial muscles, there'll be a lot of tension there, and kind of aggression, a forward kind of stance like that, for example. Your mirror neuron system will cause your body to mirror the same thing. So, if you begin to hold your body more like that, don't be at all surprised if you start feeling angry or anxious after a while. And this is why when Harvard did that study of 12,000 people, 250,000 social connections, they found that approximately 25% of your happiness is actually a consequence of the emotional state of your friends. Right? So because of that phenomena, emotions become contagious. If you're feeling happy, you project happiness. If you're feeling sad, you can project sadness. Right? And we all do it to a different extent. Some people are very efficient transmitters. Some people are very efficient receivers. Right, really, really efficient receivers. You have a scale called the emotional contagion scale, 0 to 60 points. The further up the scale you go, the more likely you are to catch emotion from people. So I'll talk a wee bit more of that quite soon. But because of this phenomena, smiling becomes contagious. Right? You know, you never waste a smile. You ever notice if you catch someone off guard with a big smile, they usually smile back? Right? Well, some people don't. But I'll argue the fact that they really do, they just don't know that they do. Right? And the reason I'm saying that is because at the University of Uppsala in Sweden, they did a really cute little experiment where they asked people, 40 volunteers, to sit in front of a computer screen, and they would present them with an image on the screen, a facial image. Now, the image they were presented with was a neutral facial expression, so just like that. It was neither happy or sad. It was just kind of neutral. And everyone was asked, what did you see on the screen? And they said, well, I saw that guy go like that. And they said, fair enough, did you not see anything else? And they said, no, that's all we saw. While they looked at that facial expression, everyone had their zygomaticus major wired up to little sensors. It's called facial EMG, that measures tiny micro-stimulation of the muscles to see if there's any activity in the muscle. And everyone said, so, yeah, I just saw that face. What they didn't know is just before that facial expression came on, the guy going like that, just before, for 25 one-thousandths of a second, someone came on the screen going like that, smiling. But no one saw it, because it was within 25 one-thousandths of a second, which is actually faster than your eye will detect. So nobody saw it. You could even say it was subliminal. But every single person, without exception, their zygomaticus major went like that. And they smiled. They didn't know that they smiled, but they did. Right? Then they did another experiment. This time, you know, sometimes if you smile at someone, not only do they not smile back, but they go like that, they go... smile, you know. They growl at you, give you a really sour look, kind of thing. Those people also smile. You might think they're frowning, but actually they smile before they frown. You cannot overrule a smile, a contagious smile. It's a reflex reaction in the brain. It's so fast, your conscious mind cannot get the frown in first. This is the other experiment they did. This time, volunteers would sit in front of a computer screen. This time they were told, in a few seconds' time you will see a face, right? And it'll be a happy face. When you see the happy face, the moment you see it, scowl at it. Do a big frown. Right? So everyone, of course, succeeded in doing the frown. But not before, within about 10 one-thousandths of a second, did every single person's zygomaticus major go like that. So every person smiled first. They just didn't know that they smiled. So see, when you smile at someone in the street and they don't smile back at the ground at you, you go, you really smiled.
Yeah, you did.
And I can back it up with that. So you never waste a smile. You never ever waste a smile. Right? You might as well just do it. Anyway, either people will smile back or they'll wonder what you've been up to. So either way. It's a win-win. But you know, one of the things I want to get across to you is this effect is really, really strong. As far, the effect is more is stronger than you would think. Right? This is a, we have the genetic wiring that the circuitry in your brain is there before you're even born. A baby has a well-developed mirror neuron system. It's why the sound component of mirror neuron system isn't just what you see, it's what you hear as well. You hear people talking in a happy way or talking in a really sad way. Right? Your mirror neuron system mirrors that as well. A baby will, a baby who cries in a hospital ward will actually set up a wave of crying because the mirror neuron system in the baby's belief, for the brain, to them, it's me. You know, to the babies, they haven't worked out that that sound isn't me. Right? The mirror neuron system is so developed, it's so honed genetically that we literally react reflex-wise to somebody else's actions, and you can see it really clearly in a baby. But the effect in adults is extremely strong. Let me give you an example. Scientists at the University of Parma did a really clever experiment. They asked people to sit with their two fingers like that, with an elastic band around their two fingers, and they had to go like that and stretch the elastic band out, right, against the strain, so they had to move their fingers apart against the strain of the elastic band, and they had to do it 25 times. Right? So they just wanted to sit in a chair and go like that, stretch it out, you know. And then they would take a wee rest, and then they'd do 25 times again. Right? So if you were, a gym goer, you would call that two sets of 25 reps. Right? So two sets of 25 reps you would do. Right, of the finger with the elastic band situation. So they did that on six different days. Now, at the beginning of the study, and after the sixth session, they had their strength tested. So they put the finger on a machine, and they pushed apart a couple of bars to find out the maximum strength of their fingers. Now, unsurprisingly, because of the six training sessions of the two sets of 25 reps against the elastic band strain, the average gain in strength was 50%. Now, that's fair enough. But what I didn't tell you is that while each person was doing that, somebody else was sitting opposite them, watching them. Right? So let's say, for example, I know Tom goes to the gym, so let's say Tom was paired with me, and I would be doing that, and Tom's job would be to watch me doing that. Right, and that's all he's to do, just watch me. There's no communication, we don't smile at each other. All he has to do is to watch my fingers. Doing that 25 times, a wee rest 25 times. And he would watch me doing the entire six separate training sessions. Now, where I gained in strength by 50%, they decided to test Tom's strength at the start and the end. Now, as a watcher, Tom's strength would have increased by 33%. Isn't that extraordinary? A 33% increase in strength, and all you've actually done is sat on your backside watching someone else doing a lot. You technically haven't even lifted a finger. Do you know, you could actually go to the gym and sit in the cafe. Sit in the cafe drinking your coffee, watching everyone else slogging out. I just hurt myself a tooth in the mouth. But you're just watching everyone else doing their stuff. Your people are on the treadmill sweating away, and you're just watching them. Keep up there. We've got faster, aren't you? Any chance you can turn up a notch? Feel like I really want a good workout today. Thanks. But I'm telling you, this is actual scientific fact. And, you know, people, athletes are now beginning to understand that they can watch people, very able-bodied people, and not even studying them, but just literally watching them, and their muscles begin to work like them. There's a good piece of research done at the University of Wales in Bangor, where the research was published as Bend It Like Beckham, Embodying the Motor Skills of Famous Athletes, where people had to watch videos of David Beckham taking a free kick, Wayne Rooney kicking a ball, Roger Federer hitting a tennis ball, Tiger Woods at a golf ball. They had to watch them doing that. Well, their entire body was wired up to little devices that would measure the stimulation of their muscles. You know, when they watched David Beckham kick a ball, every single muscle required to take a free kick in that perfect way was stimulated. When they watched Roger Federer doing that, all the muscles required to hit a tennis ball were stimulated. If they watched Tiger Woods, again, all the muscles required, all the muscles, the arm here, the face, the jaw, the neck, the twisting of the whole body, every muscle required was stimulated. And what's really interesting, see if they would watch someone who wasn't as good as Tiger Woods, their muscles would be stimulated in that way. If you want to be really good at something, study someone who's really good at it. because your muscles will learn from them. Even if you're not aware consciously and understanding how they do it, just watching them, your muscles learn. It's one of the ways, again, this is a genetically wired thing, it's how we learn from each other so fast. Because the brain is actually processing the actions of other people. One of the first times I spoke about this, a woman came up with a really good counter. She said, that can't be right. It can't be right. Because let me tell you something, she said it's a scientific fact. She said, my husband has been sitting in front of the TV watching football for 25 years. And he is not very fit. And he has certainly not got fitter. And he's certainly not become a good football player. And he's now about 2.5 stone heavier than he was a few years back. And she said, so that what you're saying can't be true. And I said, now let me ask you a question. When he's watching the football, is he watching the mechanical movements of the player's arms and legs and body, or is he watching the ball? And I said, and she said, oh, maybe the ball. And I said, well then, if the mirror neuron system is in the only thing that's going to happen is you're going to end up being shaped like the ball. And you've just told me he's put on 2.5 stone. So it's a very, very powerful thing. Now, that type of phenomena has not escaped clinical attention, because now people are saying, scientists are cleverly saying, well, okay, if watching someone moving can stimulate your own muscles, because in a real sense, although this might sound a bit out there, but your brain can't distinguish between whether you're doing something or whether you're imagining doing it. But even further, your brain can't distinguish between whether you're doing something, imagining doing it, or watching someone else doing it. Because they all go through the same circuitry of the brain. The mirror neuron system part for there just sits above the actual movement part of the brain, and it just connects right with it. So within a few milliseconds, your brain can't tell the difference between whether you're doing something or watching someone else doing the same thing. So some clever scientists thought, what about people who've had a stroke, who can't actually move the body? Could their body be taught to move by just watching other people? So really good piece of research, took people who'd had a stroke, put them in two groups. Everyone got a 6-week course in physiotherapy. Then everyone got a half-hour session of progressive muscle relaxation at the end of each physio session. The other one half of them would sit in a waiting room afterwards, while the other half would spend a period of time, it was either half an hour or an hour, watching an able-bodied person reach and pick up a glass and take a drink from it. They would watch an able-bodied person, this is actually one of the things in the study, they would watch an able-bodied person turning the pages of a book. Right? But what they're watching is someone moving, mechanically moving the muscles of their arm in a way that they're not able to do because of the muscular impairment. I think one of the things in the study, they watched someone eating an apple. But again, they're watching the movements. Amazingly, after 6 weeks, those who did the watching, the scientists call it action observation, they recovered much more than those who just did the physiotherapy. So a great combination for stroke rehabilitation was physiotherapy plus action observation, observing an able-bodied person. Now, I think even more exciting than that, because of the increase in Alzheimer's, the most recent clinical application of the mirror neuron system is in the treatment of Alzheimer's disease. And this is so incredible that I can't wait till this gets into mainstream. Scientists studying the mirror neuron system have been able to create a little map by taking MRIs of people when they watch someone reaching for, if they watch someone reaching and grasping a ball. If you watch someone doing that while you're inside an MRI scanner, you watch a video of someone doing that, you can see different areas of the brain lighten up. And you can plot a little map. And you can say, this is the mirror neuron system, the map of the mirror neuron system, when a person's reaching and grasping for an object. Now, so the scientists studying this know what that map looks like. Now, people studying Alzheimer's have also created a little map. And it's a little map of areas of the brain that are susceptible to Alzheimer's. They get these little things called amyloid plaques. It's little plaque formations that actually interrupt the communication in the brain. And so they've plotted a little map of the Alzheimer's areas that were susceptible. Now, it just so happened that some people studying Alzheimer's seem to be aware of the map of the mirror neuron system, or it was the other way around. The people doing the mirror neuron system Matt happened to be aware of the Alzheimer's map, and they looked at the two of them and thought, isn't that incredible? Because they overlap in a lot of areas. And they thought, if they overlap, could a way to treat Alzheimer's be, in a sense, taking the brain to the gym and almost shaking off the plaque, so to speak? So that's kind of what they did. They went into a nursing home, and this was just 18 months ago, this was published, this research. They went into a nursing home and they found 30 residents who had Alzheimer's disease. They split them into two groups. One group, 5 days a week, would watch a 30-minute documentary. Right? Now, I don't know what it was. But let's say, for example, it was like Discovery Channel stuff, you know, March of the Penguins, that kind of stuff, Blue Planet, all that kind of things. And the other group, they would instead, during that half hour, they would watch videos of people going like that, reaching for and grasping for bottles of water and other objects, right? How bummed did you be during that group? And your pals are watching, you know, the wildebeest getting his leg hacked off by the crocodile and stuff like that, and you're watching people going like that for half an hour, day by day. But incredibly, after the 6 weeks, those who did the watching or the action observation, they outperformed in every single test, cognitive improvement, memory test, those who just watched the documentary. In a real sense, what had happened is they'd taken the brain to the gym. They'd actually exercised parts of the brain that were clogged up with these amyloid plaques. They'd literally shook the plaques off, metaphorically speaking. By exercising that part, and by exercising that part, all they actually had to do is stimulate it by watching people doing that, because watching people doing that stimulates the exact part of the brain that's affected through Alzheimer's. So that's the most recent application of it, and I would really love to see that getting far more clinical investigation, a lot more research dollars put into that, too, because I think that could be an incredible treatment in the future once it's really hit mainstream. But another thing I wanted to get across is, so that's how strong the effect is, that's how really strong this contagion effect is. So if you're expressing emotion, that's how strong the projection of emotion is onto other people. But what's really interesting is what research of this type has shown, that the brain can't distinguish between whether you're doing something or whether you're watching someone else doing it. What that's now showing us is that we live in a really interconnected world. Now, I know on a very deep level, and I guess many of you, because this is SSP, are very aware of a lot of the research that shows a very subtle interconnectedness, perhaps facilitated through a projection of consciousness, the extended mind, that kind of idea, or even at the quantum level, I believe there is a very deep interconnectedness. I mean, I'm absolutely 100% convinced of that. And I would say that as a scientist myself, I'm absolutely convinced there is a subtle interconnectedness through all of life. But on a primary neurological level, there's a very deep connectedness that's very well accepted by mainstream science now, and accepted being because you can't really argue with it, because it's really, really obvious if you think about it. Because the mirror neuron system brings us into an interconnected space, because what it's like is, if you're in company with someone, let's say there's someone at the other side of the room who's sitting smiling to themselves going, I feel really good, and you happen to just catch them out the corner of your eye, your mirror neuron system begins to mirror their state. But because emotion is four component, it's the subjective feeling, chemistry of the brain, it's the effect on your autonomic nervous system, and it's the effect on your peripheral, your muscular. What's happening is your nervous system is now processing their emotional state. Right? Think about it. Your nervous system, your autonomic nervous system, parts of your central nervous system, are now processing that person's emotional state. You could think of it like your nervous system doesn't stop at your skin, but projects, like invisible tentacles, literally projects out your body, and is like roots from a tree, but invisible, and it's literally sampling the emotional state of every single person that you're focusing on at the time, and processing their stuff through your nervous system. So your body, your chemistry, begins to process their stuff. And I know people who do healing are well aware of that kind of thing. What I love is this is something that's very acceptable in mainstream science, because it's very obvious. If you think about it, the mirror neuron system shows us that the nervous system is actually processing other people's stuff. The longer you're with someone, the more your nervous system will do that. So you really can think of it like these, like a web of interconnectedness. We're all part of this. We've all got roots flying all over the place. Literally, if I wanted to know how Tricia was feeling, and I just look at her, my tentacles, my nervous system has gone over her face and seen her zygomaticus major, go, oh, a bit of activity in the zygote there, have a bit of that, and it sends a feedback pulse back to me, so there's like an extension of my body sampling Trish's emotional state, and now I'm processing the chemistry of my brain and the chemistry of my organs, my autonomic nervous system, is now processing how she's feeling. So in other words, we are really deeply connected in that kind of way, and it applies to absolutely every person. And that actually forms part of the intuition equation. Mm. You know, sometimes, you ever noticed that sometimes someone will say something, but you get a feeling that's not quite right? Someone will pretend they're okay, but actually you get a sense sometimes they're really suffering. And that's because if someone's pretending they're okay, and feeling happy, but really they're suffering inside, what happens is, during a conversation, there'll be millisecond flashes of emotion on their face that some studies show last no longer than 2/1000th of a second. Your eye cannot possibly pick it up, but your mirror neuron system picks it up, no problem at all. And that sends a little feedback signal through your emotional circuitry, and you just get a feeling. Right? It's not the complete intuition equation. Obviously, there's a deeper, more subtle connectedness between us all, but on the primary neurological level, actually forms a really strong part of how we can sense how other people are feeling. And this begs the point: should I improve my intuition? Should I not just trust how I feel? Because the more you trust it, the more you stop blocking what you're feeling. So it's actually a genetically hardwired thing that was probably selected by evolutionary processes because it helps us to understand each other. So we live in this deeply interconnected world. But let me give you an example of something that paints an even more interconnected picture. You ever noticed how sometimes, Trish and I were talking about this earlier today, that if someone goes over on their ankle, you ever feel a like that? You ever heard of sympathy pain, or like pregnancy pains, a husband doubles up in pain and the wife's right? That's part of the same type of phenomena. Some scientists did a really clever experiment. They put husband and wife couples in an experiment. They put the wife inside an MRI scanner, and they were scanning an area of the brain called the secondary somatosensory cortex. Really, it's like a reflexology map of the foot. You know what a reflexology map looks like, and you see an area for the heart and the liver and the kidneys and stuff. The individual areas, that's called somatotopically organised, meaning it's organised into little units, little sections. There's a section for this, a section for that. Many areas of the brain are also somatotopically organised. One part of the part of the brain that senses where someone's touching you is somatotopically organised. The part that senses how sore it is somatotopically organised. So what they were doing, they were looking at that part of the brain, so the bit that was aware of different locations of the body. And she was watching a video of her husband in the next room. And they took a dirty great big long needle and jabbed it in his leg. Another version of the experiment, they gave the person an electric shock in their ear. But what was interesting, at the exact moment when they jabbed the needle in the husband's leg, the wife's brain processed it as if it was her leg. Right? And her brain could not distinguish one iota between whether it was her leg getting jabbed or whether it was her husband's leg. To her brain, it was exactly the same thing. The only difference was in she didn't physically feel the pain, because the actual pain sensing, that the pain level region is slightly apart. Some people it's integrated into it, and you actually do physically feel other people's pains, and that's more common than you would know. But what's interesting is the brain couldn't distinguish between whether someone else is feeling something or you're feeling it. So how much of the time when you're going about your life, when you're with people in company, is your nervous system actually processing their stuff? Don't be at all surprised if you come away feeling a certain way after being with a person, and it's actually a consequence of how they were feeling, that you're now feeling their stuff, and your body in a sense is actually processing it. What's even more interesting, there's a condition called synesthesia, which is integrated into this. It's when two parts of the brain that are usually separate can overlap. Right, so when a person physically feels another's pain, it's when the pain intensity region overlaps with that reflexology map, right, and they communicate with each other. Now, an interesting case of synesthesia was presented at the International Neuroscience AGM in July of last year by the group of one of the world's most eminent neuroscientists, a guy called Vilayu Ramachandran. And they were presenting a case history of a 23-year-old autistic male who could see auras of colour around people. Now, I love that this was being presented by one of the world's most eminent neuroscientists, because I remember teaching myself how to see auras. Anyone ever read the Celestine Prophecy? Yeah. I read that back in... I was a full-time scientist with AstraZeneca, and I read that book in 1998. And after then, I was sitting against white backgrounds trying to look at auras in my hands and all that. And eventually, I was able to quite efficiently see colours. And sometimes, depending on the setting, depending on the person, sometimes it was so bright, it was like a neon light beside a bit, right there in a person's ear along the side. And I almost started to notice that when I was trying to do it. But what confused me is I thought the aura was supposed to be this physical emanation of powder or smoke or something, but I didn't see. What I was actually seeing was, it looked like my eyes were processing something differently. In which case, what's really happening is your brain is processing something differently. And I kind of didn't really think about it much. I thought, that's interesting. I didn't really think about it much until I read this piece of research by Ramakandran's group. And this guy, 23-year-old, he's autistic. When he was a child, his mum was so sympathetic because he couldn't relate to people. He couldn't be in social situations. Anyone who knows any experience with autism, you have autism spectrum disorder, and you have a range. And people who are at one end of the scale, it's very difficult to understand people, very difficult to communicate in social situations. Because with that type of autism, the mirror neuron system isn't wired, it's not connecting properly with the emotional parts. There's a wee emotional part called the insula, and with autism, it's believed that that part of the insula isn't integrated into the mirror neuron system. So the body, the brain still mirrors, but just doesn't get the emotional bit. Now, depending on what piece of research you read, about 60 to 90% of the content of every single conversation you have is non-verbal. In other words, only about 10 to 40% of what you pick up from people in conversations is the words that they say. 60 to 90% is in how they say it. And also the emotional content that comes through the facial expressions, the vocal intonations. Your brain actually processes most stuff in that way. So you actually take on the feeling, the emotion of the conversation more than you do the actual words. If you take that part of the brain out, then all you're left with is the words and the black and white meaning of a word. And that's what sometimes happens with autism, is you only get 10 to 40% of the conversation. So there's no emotional understanding, so it's very black and white, yes or no. So what you find is a difficulty fitting into social situations. So his mum thought, there must be something I can do. She was told, there's nothing you can do. She said, I don't accept that. So they played a little game, and it was a colours game. Whenever he saw someone smiling, he was to think of that smile as a colour. So let's say he chose yellow. And whenever he saw someone frown or be angry, he had to think of that as a colour. So let's say he thought of grey, for argument's sake. And then if someone was like really excited about something, he was to think of a colour, he'd maybe think purple. And if someone was like really kind of nervous about something, he'd maybe think, you know, brown or tartan or something like that. It wasn't Scottish. But what was happening is he would associate different colours with different facial expressions. Now, what happened in the brain is the area of the brain that processes colour, it's called V4, began to overlap with the mirror neuron system. It took the place of the insula and it stitched itself into the mirror neuron system. So what happened now, the mirror neuron system, instead of feeling emotion, is now wired into the colour perception part. So instead of feeling emotion when he's with people, he saw emotion. So when a person was happy, he would see an envelope of colour around them. Person sad, he'd see a different envelope. And the colour would change all the time as that person's emotional state changed. So Ramakandran's group actually studied them and proved that that's actually what happened, and that every person has that capability to see auras of colour around each other. The reason I'm telling you is because it's another way that your nervous system and your brain can process other people's stuff. Because with him, it's like his nervous system was extended out, and it's just, instead of processing it through the feelings, his nervous system is processing it through colour. Right? So I find that type of stuff absolutely incredible, because it shows that just at the neurological level, just at the level of your nervous system, we are deeply interconnected. It's like a spider's web that interconnects every single person. You know, how does a spider know a fly's trapped in its web? It feels the vibrations. In a very similar way, your nervous system is feeling the vibrations of everyone's emotional state all of the time. Now, what if you're in a situation where you don't want to catch emotion from someone? Do you think there's things you can do to deflect it? Well, you really can. I have to learn this for myself because when I did the emotional contagion scale test, I scored in the 95th percentile, so I was like really, really high, which means you could define that as an emotional sponge. Right? I mean, I cry watching Neighbours. It's kind of embarrassing. But basically, I'm very, very susceptible to catching emotion, but I'm also very efficient at projecting emotion as well, and they usually go very well together with kind of things like that. But what I had to learn for myself is, what if you're in a situation that you're soaking up negative emotion, anger, aggression? You know, what if you're soaking up anxiety? What if you're soaking up depression? What if you don't want to? What do? It turns out it's so incredibly simple. It's so incredibly simple stopping it. Right? Now, I had to learn, before I tell you how to do that, I had to learn this for myself. When I first did this emotional contagion scale test, I finally understood something I didn't understand when I was a child. Because I've probably always been that emotional sensitive in that way. Now, when I was young, and when my mum gave birth to my youngest sister in 1976, Lynn, I was 5 years old, and my mum went into postnatal depression. And back in the 70s, depression wasn't understood the way it is now. The advice my mum was given at the doctors was, give yourself a shake. Right? And that's the advice she got given there, and it made my mum feel like even worse, because she thought it's her fault. You know, she should be feeling better and all, but we know now from postnatal depression it's a chemical imbalance in the brain, right? But it wasn't understood that way back then. But being highly emotionally sensitive, I was catching my mum's emotion. Not so much the depression, I was catching the anxiety. My mum was taking panic attacks almost every day, right? Now, my mum never showed the kids. My mum still is a great mum and a great gran to the nephews and nieces. And she never showed that. But being highly emotionally sensitive, my mirror neuron system was full of processing the background pockets of time how my mum was feeling. And I didn't question it. I just thought everyone felt anxious all the time. And I had so many times as a child just feeling really nervous and anxious for no apparent reason. But as a child, you don't know that everyone else, you just assume everyone feels that way. Like I did. Anyway, there was one particular time in my life where that was really, really, it was really, the effect of it was really taking its toll. I think I was about 8 or 9 years old, and I was at primary school, and I had a teacher that I don't think should be allowed to teach, because I was terrified of the woman. In fact, before I got her, when they were deciding who was going to, which class you were in the following year, I would say, please don't let me here, please. Because every time I walked past our class, all I heard was this voice shouting at the kids, roaring at the top of her voice, screaming at kids. And I was terrified of her. And my heart sunk when I found out that's who my teacher is. Anyway, that's what she did. But depending on what mood she was in, at the end of the day, if she was in a bad mood, she wouldn't let us away when the bell went at 3:30. Right? Now, that might not sound like a big deal, but it was a big deal to me, because I went to a school in Denny. And I live in Banknock, and I had to get a bus home. So there was a service bus for the small group of people who lived in Banknock. It's about 18.4 miles from here. And for the small group of people who lived in Banknock, we had to get a service bus home. And I knew, I've always been very scientific, mathematical, I knew that the bus left at 3:37 every day. I timed it. But if this teacher was in a bad mood, and she didn't let us out when the bell went, I was now in panic attacks. What if I missed the bus? What if I missed the bus? And I'm now my leg shaking like that every day. In fact, my entire afternoon every day was dominated. From after lunch, every day was dominated with the fear of, what if she doesn't let us away in time? What if I miss the bus? Because as a child, you don't know that if you miss the bus, you just come back to the school and tell a teacher. But as a child, you don't know that. You just think, and you don't have a mobile phone, and this was probably 1978 or 79. You don't know that you could phone somebody. All you know is that you're stranded in this place, and how do I get home? So that was all I could think about. So if she was in a bad mood, the bell went and she said, stay in your seats! Well, I'm sitting like that. And if anyone moves, you know, you get the bell. This was in the days when you could get the bell in 1978-ish. And I'm sitting in my chair like that, so my heart is rate, I'm having a panic attack almost every day. and I get 3:31, I'm looking at a watch, I can't concentrate on the work, I'm just watching the second hand, and I know that when it gets to the 3:33, I can't catch the bus, because it can't run that fast. And finally she'd let us go, and I'll tell you, my arse was just a blur. Out that bus, I was gone. And realising sometimes I cannot catch the bus if I take the normal route, I'm going to have to take a shortcut over the back of the church, through the church gardens. Oh, now there was this wall that was taller than I was, and I would run at that wall at full pelt, and I would take a leap and run and jump onto that wall, grab it and flip it over it. It's no surprise, as an adult, I became one of Scotland's top long jumpers. Incidentally, you know, because I trained for it for a year in that class. But anyway, but every day I was totally dominated with anxiety, right? Whereas one of my friends, a guy called John McGrandles, he's walking up the road every day. So the bus is leaving at 3:37, walking around the corner, and the bus passes, and the driver notices John McGrandles walking up with a couple of guys with a ball like that, just taking his time. And he's going, and he's so relaxed, so laid back he could have fallen over. And the bus is waiting at the corner with the hazard lights flashing while he walks up the road. The contrast between him taking it easy, not a care in the world, and me, panic attacks, was like shock and cheese. And what I understand now is because I was living in an environment around panic attacks and stuff, my mirror neuron system was catching that emotion, right? Obviously, that certainly wasn't my mum's fault. It's a chemical imbalance in the brain. But that's how, because I've been so emotionally sensitive, I learned for myself how to not catch emotion. And you know, it's so simple. Right? Anyone who does healing work and you wonder, how do I not catch people's stuff? It's the simplest thing in the world. I'm working up to it. It's almost like I'm going to sell something to you. No, it's so simple. The way you catch emotion, remember what I said earlier, emotion is 4 components. Part of that is the mirroring of the body language, the facial expressions. When you're catching negative emotion, you'll probably not even notice that you're doing it, but your facial muscles are mirroring theirs. And your shoulders are tightening, your jaw will tighten, you'll stop breathing, your chest will cave forward, and you'll start mirroring the person unconsciously. As you do that, it's like you're opening the door to the flood of emotion. So what do you think you would do to not catch emotion? Just don't mirror it. Yeah. Just do the opposite. Open your chest. What I do is I scramble the facial muscles. I find this really efficient, because much of the gateway for emotional contagion is in the facial muscles. So what I do is that. And exercise all the muscles, scramble all the circuits. Of course, you're at a meeting. So you do it covertly. You pretend you're rubbing your eyes and you go like that. Behind you, as if you're rubbing your face, because nobody knows you're doing it, right? But then what you do is you notice that you're going like that, and your shoulders are up at your ears. So what you do is you relax your shoulders, you open your shoulders, and you breathe. And immediately, the incoming signal of emotion stops. You can't possibly catch negative emotion if you're not mirroring. You can't, you cannot possibly catch it if you're breathing like that. You can't catch a negative emotion in that environment. The only way to do it is if you're mirroring the person. The more you mirror, the more efficient. You can still catch a residual amount, but it's hard work to catch it, especially if you're doing that. Shoulders back and you're breathing, and if you can, try to relax your facial muscles. If particularly, relax that one there, it's your corrugator supercilii. It's one of the reasons why new scientific studies show that one of the interesting side effects of Botox is it becomes a mild antidepressant, because you can't no longer simulate the corrugator supercilii, so you can't catch negative emotion from people. It's being debated at the moment. It's an interesting side effect of Botox, is it breaks down emotional contagion of the negative form. Right? But anyway, so I've had to learn how to do this, and I'll give you an example of one time that I actually did it not too long ago. And what I did, what you can do actually when you interrupt this signal, you stop catching negative emotion, what you want to do then is project positive emotion. Now it's really simple how to project that as well. You can use your voice, and you can lift your voice at certain parts like that, and you'd be surprised at how much people's emotional state is tweaked by your language. Anyone who does NLP is well aware of this, but simple changes in words can have a very big effect on people and how their muscles are even working. I mean, what I do purposely, and if you study charismatic presenters, you will find all of them do this. And people, when you start, you learn presentation skills. For some reason, nobody's picked up on this, but it's so obvious. Notice the language that's used. People who are very efficient projectors of positive emotion use much more positive language. Right? They word things in a positive way more. But in particular, they use positively emotive words. Like, for example, instead of saying, I had a good time last night, I had an excellent time. Good, excellent, carrying more emotion. It was a wonderful experience. It was fantastic. Oh, it was an awesome night. Right? Rather than just saying, that was quite good. No. I had a nice walk in the park. Damn it, I had an amazing walk in the park. And you can use it, lift it up. But what you also do is you take that positive emotive word and you stretch it out an extra half second, right? And what you're doing with the mirror neuron system is you're immersing people's mirror neuron system for an extra half second in the quality of that word. Does that make sense? Right? You do it on purpose. Sometimes when I do workshops on this, I videotape everyone. Before I tell them how to do it, I videotape everyone doing a 1 minute presentation on who they are. And then explain everyone about the quality of words and how to project emotion. You can actually use your body as well. If you move your body, if you want to lift people's emotion, subtly just do that several times and open your chest and lift. And people's mirror neuron system goes with it. Because their chest muscles lift as well, which feeds back to their emotional circuitry. There's lots of little subtle things that people do. We do it all the time. Right? We bring people down when we do that and we talk low like that. We actually bring people down unconsciously with us. So one of the things that I sometimes do in these wee workshops is then teach people the power of language and words and movement, and then we videotape them all again. And this wave, when you watch the second video, it's this wave of positivity almost knocks you over. And all you've changed is some of your language. I'll give you an example of the power of language, right? Scientists took people into what's called a language proficiency test. And they asked them to... They gave them a set of sentences containing five words, and they had to make a sentence containing four of five words. And they had to do this like 30 times. So they've got five words, make a sentence containing four of them, do it loads and loads of times. Now, one half of them got a standard set of words. The other half, the scientists swapped five words and put five extra ones in. Old, grey, wrinkle, bingo, and lonely. Old, great, wrinkle, bingo, lonely. Words which carry meaning of being old. Right? What was amazing about this study is after each person finished their test and they had to walk out, they had to leave the room and walk out of the building, they had to walk down the corridor. One of the scientists was sitting outside the room with a stopwatch, pretending he was the next person in for the test. And when each person passed him, he went, and he timed how long it took them to walk down the corridor. Right? To a little mark he placed with masking tape on the floor. When they got to the locker, and he walked down how long it took them. It turned out, the people who got the ordinary set of words, the average time to walk down the corridor was 7.28 seconds. People who got the old words, old, grey, wrinkle, bingo, and lonely. The normal people got 7.28 seconds. The ones who got the old words, 8.32 seconds. 13.5% longer it took them to walk down the corridor. And all they'd actually picked up was the words old, grey, wrinkle, bingo, and lonely. What if instead of doing that, you shove in fascination, excitement, enthusiastic words, awesome words? You had a brilliant time tonight, didn't you?
Yes.
Fantastic! It was brilliant, it was awesome! You can just pick these words and stretch stuff out. I do it all the time, you probably noticed. But so you can use. I'll give you an example. When I put all this into practice a couple of months ago, earlier in the year, you know, sometimes you know all this stuff, but you forget your own stuff, right? As I write, I'm the first person to put my hand up and say I write about this stuff, and I forget my own stuff all the time, you know. And anyway, it was a family situation. Some family were visiting us in Windsor, and some of them were getting tore in about each other with arguments, and they start to get that personal. And me being Mr. Emotional Sponge, I'm sitting on the couch and the three of them really going, getting aggressive and getting really, you know, personal with each other. And I'm sitting on the couch like that, forgetting my own stuff. And my face is like that. My corrugator supercilia is almost right through, knitting itself through my skull. My My shoulders are up like that, my chest is caved in, and I'm not breathing. I'm totally exhaled my breath. My stomach's as tight as a board and like that. And I'm feeling nervous. Really nervous. Actually feeling like really nervous, shaky nervous. Now, I sometimes have been so sensitive in situations, I have physically thrown up sometimes when people are really angry. Right? Still it breaks up the argument if it lands on the floor. But that's some people like myself are very sensitive in that way. So I'm sitting in this environment feeling very toxic, very horrible with this toxic environment. And you know sometimes when you're in a stressful environment, your brain stops working. You know, so you can't think clearly. You know why that is? If you take an MRI scan of someone under stress, you lose about 60% of the resources from the prefrontal cortex of the brain, which is this bit at the front, which is the higher order function. It's where you concentrate and make decisions and think clearly. If you drain 60% of the resources there, it's no surprise you can't think clearly, because half those resources have gone back towards the old reptilian, the self-preservation sections of the brain. That's really all about just protecting yourself. So anyway, my brain isn't working. I'm not thinking clearly that I could really interrupt all this. And I'm sitting last for ages, and all of a sudden, a little thought emerged in my mind that said, what am I doing here? What am I doing? I should be deflecting all this stuff. So you know what I did? But I pretended I was just going like that. And then what I did, I moved it into chest out, and I put, just to make sure I put my chest out, I put my hands along the settee like that. And then I started to breathe from here. For about 3 or 4 minutes. And I have to tell you, I didn't instantly change my state. I reckon it took about 3 or 4 minutes. And I think because you've got a residual charge in your nervous system of their stuff. But immediately, the incoming stopped. But it took about 3 or 4 minutes to get rid of the residual charge. Because see, after about 3 minutes, I'm sitting here feeling absolutely fantastic. And I'm thinking, this is amazing. They're going hammer and tong at each other. I'm feeling incredible. And that's when all the resources come back at the prefrontal cortex, and I think, I don't even need to be here. I thought, I'm going to wait and make myself some tea and a bit of toast. So without saying a word, I just got up and walked into the kitchen. Anyway, to maintain my positive emotional state, what you want to do is move your body to create the movement and motion of positive emotion generates the emotion. So I'm walking out in the kitchen like that, and I'm taking a wee and I'm moonwalking, you know, and I put the kettle on, I put the toast on like that, and I'm moonwalking, but I'm doing a wee dance like that, you know, and I'm just boosting my positivity, feeling really good. The toast comes up and I'm like, and I'm buttering all that, drink my tea, and I thought, I'm feeling great, I'm going to now go in and I'm going to disrupt all this nonsense, and I'll see how quickly I can do it. So I put my tea nut down, and you set this positive state, and I thought, I'm going to project like a tsunami of positive emotion. So I walked out, I thought, I need to catch their attention first of all. So what I did is I walked out the living room, they're all still going out, and I went, I've got a brilliant joke to tell you. And I said it really loud, like, louder than they went, brilliant joke. And they went, what? And I went, oh, it's awesome. I heard it the other day, you'll pee yourself laughing. And all the signals are getting scrambled. Because I'm my emotions are overwhelming their negative, their toxicity. And then I told this really crap joke that wasn't funny at all, but I just wanted to get their attention. So I wouldn't even embarrass myself by telling you because it's that bad. But anyway, see, within about a minute, they were hugging each other and crying. They were agreeing. You know, I really love you. I didn't mean that. And they were hugging each other. And I'm going, score. About 1 minute that took. So if you can build up the positivity, it's almost like a tidal wave. You really knock people over. You know, I felt I was on the receiving end of it, actually. I was over in San Diego last month. It's the head of my publishing house, Louise Hay. It's her 85th birthday last month. And she's so filled with vitality. She actually looks and moves healthier than she was when she was 60, when she self-published her first book at 60, actually. And I've met her quite a few times now. And I went over there, and she was meeting and greeting everyone as we're coming into a party. And I said, Louise, you look amazing. You're so filled with vitality. And she says, of course, I'm 85. And the way she said it was positivity being knocked over. You know, it's just like, why shouldn't I be? You know, I'm 85. So you can put all this into practice. Now, what I wanted to say is there is a difference in between men and women, statistically, in how likely you are to catch emotion capital. Right? The sex of the two sexes that are more likely to catch emotion are the ones who are most likely to talk about their feelings and share emotion. Which sex would you say that was? Yet statistically, women are about 10% more susceptible to emotional contagion than men are. Although it's not an absolute rule, because, you know, some women are very non-empathetic, non-susceptible, and some men are extremely. But what you find, if you average it out over like 1,000 people, what you'll find is women generally are more susceptible than men. A good way to remember this: anyone fans of Friends, the US sitcom?
Yeah.
Friends, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, those of you who don't know what it is, you remember the scene where two of the main characters, Ross and Rachel, in the second series, shared their first kiss, right? So anyway, the scene cuts. Right, Ross and Rachel, two of the primary characters, it's three guys, three girls, and they're all friends, and Ross and Rachel, two primary characters, share their first kiss. The scene cuts, and Rachel is sitting in the living room with the two girls, Phoebe and Monica, and she said, "Ross kissed me last night." And the two girls went, "Oh my God, tell us all the, every detail. And then Monica runs into the kitchen, grabs three wine glasses, a bottle of wine, and she's running back saying, "Do not start without me, do not start without me." And she gets back in and just tells every detail, everything that happened, from the start of the night right till the end. And Rachel says, "Well, he put his hand behind my hair, he stroked my hair," and Monica's like that, and Phoebe's taking palpitations, it's so emotional, overwhelming. And then he moved in and he placed his hand in my cheek like that, and we kissed. And Monica was so overwhelmed with emotion, she almost fell off her chair, kind of thing. The scene cuts to the three guys, and they're sitting in the kitchen eating pizza, and Ross says to Joey and Chandler, "Kissed Rachel last night." Joey stops eating pizza, looks across, and he goes, "Tongue?" And Ross says, "Yup." And Joey went, "Cool." And they went back to the pizza. But because of that stereotypical situation, women are about 10% more likely to catch emotion. It's because they're more likely to express emotion and talk about feelings. But just to come back to what I said about Harvard research at the start, Harvard found about 25% of the average person's happiness level at any one time is actually a consequence of the emotional state of your friends. Now, that's the average. For close friends, about 63% of your happiness can actually be a consequence of the happiness level of your close friend. Right? But what's interesting is Harvard found an interesting phenomenon going on. If you're feeling happy and you project happiness onto your friends and your family, do you think it stops there?
No, of course not.
Of course not, yeah. Because could they not take that improvement feeling and project it onto someone else? Absolutely. What Harvard found is that happiness projects outwards to 3 degrees of separation. Right? That means 3 social steps. In other words, you infect with emotion your friends' friends, and your friends' friends' friends. And they found that statistically, with 12,000 people and 250,000 social connections, is that happiness went out to 3 social steps, 3 degrees of separation. Anyone heard of the 6-degree rule? Yeah, 6-degree rule. As an MIT professor calculated this, that there is no greater than 6 social steps between any 2 people on the planet. In other words, you know someone who knows someone who knows someone who knows someone who knows someone who personally knows Nelson Mandela, or Barack Obama, or His Holiness the Dalai Lama, or Kevin Bacon, the actor. There's a popular game called 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon. Drunk people play it. You see how many social steps you can take to get to Kevin Bacon. Do you know someone who knows someone who knows him? I get it free, kind of thing. But isn't it amazing, right? There's 6 degrees of separation in the whole world, but your happiness goes out to 3. Isn't that extraordinary? The level of emotional contagion, of how much you transmit emotion onto other people. Now, what's interesting, when Harvard drew the social network in a big map thing, what they found is, on average, the people who were the happiest were also the ones who had the most social contact. Right? The people who were least happy or most depressed were the ones who had the least amount of social contact. And what they found is, for every extra friend that you had, increased your happiness score by approximately 1 point on a 16-point scale. Right? Amazingly. And of course, it's not an absolute rule, because some people statistically, take out the statistics, some people who had a lot of friends were very unhappy, and some people who had no social contact were very happy. But averaged out over 12,000 people, what you found very powerfully was more social contact equates to more happiness. Least social contact equates to least happiness. And another interesting spin-off comes out of this kind of research. It turns out people who have the most social contact also have the healthiest hearts, healthiest cardiovascular system. And that's because of a little hormone called oxytocin. Oxytocin is well known for its role in childbirth and breastfeeding, but oxytocin gets produced in your heart when you make an emotional connection with someone. So you're sitting with a friend having a laugh, having a conversation. Sitting with someone who's suffering and showing them that you care. When you hold hands with someone, when you just are having friends, a friendship experience or an emotional experience, you produce oxytocin. It attaches itself to the lining of your arteries and expands them, and that reduces your blood pressure. So oxytocin is called a cardioprotective hormone. It also cleans out about 50% of the effect. It cleans out the levels of free radicals and inflammation, which are the two primary triggers of cardiovascular disease. It reduces by about 50%, depending on what type of cell you're using. So oxytocin is called a cardioprotective hormone. So having friends and social contact and being kind, because being kind and compassionate also produces oxytocin. So having friends, having social contact, being kind and compassionate are called cardioprotective phenomena. Right? They protect your heart. And it's amazing because I remember reading something by Khalil Gibran, who wrote a book called The Prophet. And he said something that's so prophetic, because we now understand this from social network and cardiovascular research. He said, "In the sweetness of friendship, let there be laughter and sharing of pleasures. For in the dew of little things, the heart finds its morning and is refreshed." I think that's so prophetic. "In the sweetness of friendship, let there be laughter and sharing of pleasures. For in the dew of little things, the heart finds its morning and is refreshed." So I think that's what this kind of research is beginning to show us, is just how interconnected we are and how reliant we are on each other. Right? And we actually project our happiness all day. Now, as I said at the start, what I wanted to get across is could this evidence suggest if we are so incredibly contagious, because it's not just emotions that are contagious, what you also find is, looking at the social network research, heart disease and diabetes are also contagious. Not as an infectious agent, but what's contagious is the unhealthy habits. Unhealthy lifestyles contagious. We copy, we learn from other people who have unhealthy lifestyles, and they, in a sense, it's like being infected with that way of living. So therefore, obesity was found in Harvard research to go out to 3 degrees of separation. Right? In other words, if you gained a lot of weight over what they studied over a 6 month period they found in their research, then you increase the likelihood of your friends, your friends' friends, and your friends' friends' friends gaining weight. Similarly, if a friend of a friend of a friend gained weight, it can have an impact on your weight. I wrote a section in my book called "Your Sister's Hairdresser's Best Friend Can Make You Fat." But it's amazing because everything is contagious. What's also contagious, and this is what I started off with, is kindness is incredibly contagious. I have this maybe an idealistic viewpoint that kindness can change the world. I've intuitively known that since I was a child, that if enough of us show kindness and compassion towards each other, and get out of our heads this idea that, you know, I'm a British citizen. I'm not a British citizen, I'm a citizen of the world. Right? Move towards this interconnected thing, that we're all in this together, we are part of this world together, and we move towards showing in our daily lives compassion and kindness. I've always intuitively felt that would be the answer to so many of our problems in the world, is all looking out for each other kind of thing. And it turns out from also Harvard research is they found that acts of kindness also ripple out to 3 degrees of separation very efficiently. It's like you drop a pebble in a pond and it sets a wee wave. The other side of a pond, a lily pad goes like that. A lily pad, it's got no idea why it's doing that, but it's doing that because you dropped a pebble in a pond. Now, what that pebble metaphorically means is you do an act of kindness and it ripples outwards and it lifts the spirits of people 3 social steps away from you, which is half the way around the world, technically speaking. Right? And that's really how contagious it is. I'll give you a few examples from the scientific, one from the scientific journal. A publication in the New England Journal of Medicine, it's one of the premier medical journals, and it was looking at the effect, the ripple effect, they call it a domino effect, of one guy, a 28-year-old male, walked into a clinic in the United States, the West Coast, and he donated one of his kidneys. Didn't have anyone to donate to, he just said, "Look, I'm a healthy guy, I know a lot of people have you know, need kidney transplants, please, I'd like to offer one of my kidneys. And he made an altruistic donation to him. In other words, he didn't want his name being known. He didn't want any pride associated with it. He just wanted to make this gift and get on with the rest of his life. Anyway, about 2 weeks later, a blood match was found for that kidney. And that was given to someone whose husband, a woman whose husband had wanted to donate her kidney. It was donated to a guy whose wife had wanted to donate her kidney, but she wasn't a match. So in America, you have this program that you can register together. So when the wife got her kidney, the husband would give his to someone else. Right? It's like a pay it forward type thing. Right? And to have that program in America where you're allowed to do that. So the husband gave his kidney to someone else. Now, a couple of weeks later, a match was found for that, the other side of the United States. And it was a woman whose mother had wanted to donate hers, but wasn't a match. So the mother donated hers to someone else. A match was found for that, and the co-registered donor then donated theirs to someone else. And this kidney donation, in an unbroken domino chain, actually went 10 journeys back and forward across the United States over about an 18-month period. And it's called a donor chain. It's the longest unbroken donor chain ever recorded. And it was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Now, what that guy didn't realise is he made a completely altruistic, a kind act. But he's no idea to this day he saved 10 lives. When he made a kidney donation, he thinks, I'm saving one life. No, he didn't. He saved 10 lives. Right? And he also set in motion a set of connections between families that will probably never be broken, ever. It's amazing when you do an act of kindness, please know that it never stops with the person you show kindness to. You have no idea how far on it goes. You have no idea, but trust me, every act of kindness has consequences. It ripples on, most of the time, at least to 3 degrees of separation. I'll give you one more example that I found was really inspirational. When I first decided to resign from my job in AstraZeneca, in the pharmaceutical industry, I was attending a seminar run by the big giant American motivational speaker, Tony Robbins. And it was Unleash the Power Within. I'd done my very first firewalk on the Friday night. We were all pumped up, and it was a Saturday afternoon. It was taking us through this amazing visualisation where you had to think of a time in your life when something had happened that, had it not happened, your life would have gone in a different direction. And he said, now make a decision that will change the course of your life forever. And I'm so pumped, I'm like, right, I'm leaving my job. I hadn't really thought it through, I have to say. Because I had to do a 3-month notice period. I remember 6 weeks into that, I woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning in a panic, thinking, what am I? I'm leaving my job to be a public speaker, and speaking in front of people frightens the life out of me. At the time it did, I hadn't thought it through. Seemed like a good idea at the time. But anyway, Tony shared his example of what changed the course of his life. And it was actually an act of kindness when he was 11 years old. His family were really financially poor. And it was Thanksgiving, they had no money. They couldn't afford a turkey, they had nothing at all. His mother and father were having a really fierce argument over finances. And the husband was feeling really, his pride was hurt because he couldn't provide for his family. And they're having this argument, someone knocked on the door. And it was, no one heard it. So Tony, being the eldest child, he went and answered the door. And there was this big tall guy with a box of food and a turkey, an uncooked turkey, and some boxes of food on the ground. And he said, excuse me, son, is your father at home? And Tony went and got his dad. And his dad came out and he says, excuse me, sir, I understand that you're having financial difficulty. This is Thanksgiving. I would like to make this gift to you. Please take this food and have a great Thanksgiving. Tony's father got really angry. Because his pride was up, because they'd just been having an argument about finances and that he felt he couldn't provide for his own family. And here was a stranger coming in and giving charity. So instead of Tony's husband saying thank you, he got really angry and he threw the guy away and he slammed the door shut and said, that's it, off, you know, get out of my house, don't ever come back on my doorstep. But that caused a fundamental change in Tony's mind. Because he'd somehow learned or been taught that people are selfish and everyone's just out for their own gain and no one will do you any favours in life unless they want something out of you, and really everyone's just doing it for themselves, don't trust anyone, everyone's bad kind of thing. And he said, that can't be true. And he started to really question it as an 11-year-old. He said, that cannot be true, because that stranger doesn't know us, he's trying to help us. And it was such a big thing in his mind that he said, one day when I'm old enough, I'm going to save up enough money to do that for another family, what that guy tried to do for us. So a few years later, he's 17 years old, he has enough money to go and provide food for two families. He goes to the supermarket, fills loads of shopping trolleys. He goes into the local church and he asks the priest, could you give me the names and addresses of two families in need here that I could help? And the priest wrote down the names and addresses of two families. The first was a woman whose husband had abandoned them, and she had four children. They were destitute, they had no money, they were really totally broke. So Tony decided to take some food to them. But he remembered the experience with his father and the pride being hurt, so he pretended he was a delivery boy, that he was delivering on behalf of someone else. So he dressed in a little, put a little cap on, he got a delivery, he had a delivery van. So it made it look like he was just the messenger. And he wrote a little card that said something along the lines of, this is a gift from a friend, not me, this is a gift from a friend. Please accept it, you deserve it, you really do. But just please, maybe one day if you can afford to help someone else, maybe you can help them in some way. But please accept this gift. So he went to the first house, and the woman just broke down in tears, collapsed. And she's going, gift from God, gift from God. And it was such a bonding experience. The kids grabbed his leg and they attached themselves to him. He's 6'7". He's walking into the kitchen with the food and the kids are around his leg. Like that. And they had this most amazing emotional and spiritual moving experience. The woman was so overwhelmed with gratitude. And Tony was driving away and he looked out the mirror. He looked in his mirror and he could see them. They were on the doorstep. They were crying. And the kids were laughing. And the woman was laughing. Then she was crying. They were having such an experience. And it really hit home to him how easy it was to make a huge difference in someone's life. And he pulled his van over and he wept for half an hour. He was overcome with emotion of how easy it was to make a big change in a person's life. The following year, he did it for four families. The year after that, he did it for eight. And you know, during those 3 years, he didn't tell a single person what he was doing because he didn't want people to think he was great. He didn't want his own ego to think, look, what I've done for people. He did it all anonymously. But the point I was making here is, isn't it amazing that one guy turns up at Tony Robbins' door with an act of kindness when he was 11 years old, and that led to two families, then four families, then eight families being fed at Thanksgiving. Isn't that incredible? The contagious effect of kindness. But it doesn't stop there, because now the Tony Robbins Foundation International Basket Brigade, as it's called, now feeds approximately 2 million families in 25 countries around the world every single Thanksgiving and Christmas. Isn't that extraordinary? So one guy walks up to Tony Robbins' door with baskets of food and a turkey and tries to make an act of kindness. And now, because of that, 2 million people in 25 countries around the world are fed at Thanksgiving and Christmas. Mm-hmm. So I'll ask you that question again. Do you think a small group of people with compassion and kindness in their hearts can change the world? Yeah. Good, that's all I want to do. Thanks very much for listening. I'm right out of time.
The time's fine. It did occur to me that one of the benefits of SSPR membership is cardio protective sort of measures mixed with our members, and it'll do you a world of good. I actually was reading New Scientist magazine recently, and they were saying that according to a new study, we all recognise we are influenced by our friends, but according to this new study, we're influenced even more by their friends, because there's more of them. And that came to my mind. And generalisations and observations like that over large numbers, I'm sure, do contain a lot of truth about the world. But I'm not so sure it works on the individual level. Yesterday, I was took part in the strike. And I spent all day in the house and was very happy not to have done any housework. None of that happiness passed to my wife, who worked all day in school, not striking, and then came home and says, what, you've done nothing? And she didn't pick up from my happiness, and I did try and pass it on. But I suspect that she will pick up on what you've said in your talk, because she will no doubt blame me for her putting on weight. Those are my observations, but in fact, Mishka is going to formally propose the vote of thanks.
Well, I don't know how formal I can be, because I'm a bit like you. I just talk off the top of my head, and that's that. And that's one of the things I love about coming to hear David Hamilton. I've listened to him for about maybe 10 years now, so around about the start of the Spirit Aid. He came to the West of Scotland Dowsers, and then I've heard him several times here at the SSPR meetings. And I just love every time I hear there's something new that I want to kind of pass on, actually, to other people. And in fact, through doing that, some of the people here tonight are here because I said, must come along and hear David Hamilton. So that's passing it on as well. I love Khalil Gibran, the prophet that David mentioned, the book. He's a poet, or he was a poet, writer, and an artist. And his books are wonderfully illustrated, as well as that they're very, very philosophical, because he was a philosopher as well as a poet and artist. So I can highly recommend David's recommendation of the prophet. There were other things like the stroke, people who'd had strokes, people who had Alzheimer's. That really interests me enormously, and I'm sure it interests a lot of people here. And I do know that a lot of people here are also healers. And what you said about you forget your own stuff, who heals the healers? Who counsels the counsellors? Who teaches the teachers, maybe, as well? So there's a lot of stuff in there, so much that I could recover, if you like, or go on about. And I just want to say, I'm sure everybody here who's like-minded has enjoyed your talk tonight. And I know that you've got to go away and get a train, but you've come a long distance to be with us tonight, and we really, really appreciate it. So let's show David our
members can use the library facilities here at the front, although we are a little short of time and we can't manage questions. I'm sure there'll be an interesting discussion in the pub. David did not come here for the applause, but I think he would like me to say that if you picked up anything about his message tonight, he would be honoured if you would pass it on. Yeah.
David, don't stop smiling because you get old. You get old because you stop smiling.
Absolutely.
Yes. 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 See, a smile is a curve that puts most things straight.
I love that. That's a good one.
Thank you. I'm going to go to the hospital.